The remains of the Maserati lay smouldering on the side of the road. Around it, like boy scouts around a campfire, were half a dozen gendarmes in their white plastic capes and pillbox kepis. They seemed uncertain of what they should do next. Carl slowed the limousine, and Magda spoke tersely through the window to a sergeant, who treated her with immense respect.
Oui, Madame la Baronne. D'accord. Tout à fait vrai.
She dismissed him with a final nod, and he and his men saluted the departing limousine. They will find the body at the bridge. There may be another one on the edge of the forest there. You are very good, aren't you? She slanted her eyes at him. The really good ones don't get hit, he said, and smiled at her. The whiskey had taken some of the sting and stiffness out of the wound and unknotted his guts. It was good to still be alive. He started to appreciate that again. You were right about the Maserati, then. They were waiting for it. That's why I burned it, he told her, but she did not answer his smile. Oh, Peter, you'll never know how I felt. The police told me that the driver of the Maserati was still in it and had been burned. I felt as though part of me had been destroyed. It was the most terrifying feeling. She shivered. I nearly did not come. I didn't want to see it. I nearly sent my wolves, but then I had to know. Carl saw you in the river as we turned onto the bridge. He said it was you. I just couldn't believe it. She stopped herself and shuddered at the memory. Tell me what happened. Tell me all of it, she demanded, and poured more whiskey into his tumbler. For some reason that he was not sure of himself, Peter did not mention the Citroën that had followed him out of Paris. He told himself that it could not have been relevant. It must have been a coincidence, for if the driver of the Citroën had been one of them, he would have been able to telephone ahead and warn the others that Baroness Magda Altman was not in the Maserati. So that would have meant that they were not after her, but after him, Peter Stride, and that didn't make sense, because he had only set himself up as bait that very morning, and they would not have had time yet. He stopped the giddy carousel of thoughts. Shock and whiskey, he told himself. There would be time later to think it all out more carefully. Now he would simply believe that they were waiting for Magda, and he'd run into their net. He told it that way, beginning from the moment that he'd seen the police van parked in the road. Magda listened with complete attention, the huge eyes clinging to his face, and she touched him every few moments, as if to reassure herself. When Carl parked under the portico of the emergency entrance of the hospital, the police had radioed ahead, and there were an intern and two nurses waiting for Peter with a theatre trolley. Before she opened the door to let them take Peter, Magda leaned to him and kissed him full on the lips. "I'm so very glad to have you still," she whispered. And then, with her lips still very close to his ear, she went on, "It was Caliph again, wasn't it?" He shrugged slightly, grimacing at the stab of pain, and answered, "I can't think of anyone else offhand that would do such a professional job." Magda walked beside the trolley as far as the theatre doors, and she was beside his bed in the curtained cubicle, as he struggled up through the deadening, suffocating false death of the anaesthetic. The French doctor was with her, and he produced the gruesome blood-clotted souvenir with a magician's flourish. "I did not have to cut," he told Peter proudly. "Probe only." The bullet had mushroomed impressively, had certainly lost much of its velocity in penetrating the bodywork of the Maserati. "You are a very lucky man," the doctor went on. "You are in fine condition, muscles like a racehorse that stopped the bullet going deep. You will be well again very soon." "I have promised to look after you, so he is letting you home now." Magda hovered over him also. "Aren't you, doctor?" "You will have one of the world's most beautiful nurses." The doctor bowed gallantly towards Magda, with a certain wistfulness in his expression. The doctor was right. The bullet wound gave him less discomfort than the tears in his thighs from the barbed wire. But Magda Altman behaved as though he was suffering from an irreversible and terminal disease. When she did have to go up to her office suite in the Boulevard des Capucines the next day, she telephoned 3 times for no other reason than to make sure he was still alive and to ask for his size in shoes and clothing. The cavalcade of automobiles carrying her and her entourage were back at La Pierre Benite while it was still daylight. "You're keeping civil service hours," he accused, when she came directly to the main guest suite overlooking the terraced lawns and the artificial lake. "I knew you were missing me," she explained, and kissed him before beginning to scold him. "Roberto tells me you've been wandering around in the rain. The doctor said you were to stay in bed. Tomorrow I will have to stay here to take care of you myself." "Is that a threat?" he grinned at her. "For that sort of punishment, I would let Caliph shoot another hole." Swiftly she laid her fingers on his lips. "Peter, chérie, don't joke like that." The shadow that passed across her eyes was touched with fear. Then immediately she was smiling again. "Look what I have bought you." Peter's valise had been in the trunk of the Maserati, and she had replaced it with one in black crocodile from Hermes. To fill it, she must have started at the top end of the Faubourg Saint-Honoré and worked her way down to the Place Vendôme. "I'd forgotten how much fun it is to buy presents for one who you..." She didn't finish the sentence, but held up a brocade silk dressing gown. "Everybody in Saint-Laurent knew what I was thinking when I chose this." She'd forgotten nothing. Shaving gear, silk handkerchiefs and underwear, a blue blazer, slacks and shoes from Gucci, even cufflinks in plain gold, each set with a small sapphire. "You have such blue eyes," she explained. "Now, I will go and make myself respectable for dinner. I told Roberto we would eat here, for there are no other guests tonight." She had changed from the gunmetal business suit and turban into floating cloud-like layers of gossamer silk, and her hair was down to her waist, more lustrous than the cloth. "I will open the champagne," she said. "It needs 2 hands. He wore the brocade gown, with his left arm still in a sling, and they stood and admired each other over the top of the champagne glasses. "I was right," she nodded comfortably. "Blue is your colour. You must wear it more often." And he had to smile at the quaint compliment and touched her glass with his. The crystal pinged musically, and they saluted each other before they drank. Immediately she set the glass aside, and her expression became serious. "I spoke with my friends in the Sûreté. They agreed that it was a kidnap attempt against me, and because I asked it, they will not trouble you to make a statement until you feel better. I told them to send a man tomorrow to speak to you. There was no sign of the second man you shot at on the edge of the woods. He must have been able to walk or been carried by his friends." "And the other man?" Peter asked. "The dead one?" "They know him well. He has a very ugly past. Algeria with the Paras, the mutiny." She spread her hands eloquently. "My friends were very surprised that he had not killed you when he tried to do so." "I did not say too much about your own past. It is better, I think." "It's better," Peter agreed. "When I am with you like this, I forget that you also are a very dangerous man." She stopped and examined his face carefully. "Or is it part of the reason I find you so..." She searched for the word. "So compelling. You have such a gentle manner, Peter. Your voice is so soft and..." She shrugged. "But there is something in the way you smile sometimes, and in certain light your eyes are so blue and hard and cruel. Then I remember that you have killed many men. Do you think that is what attracts me? I hope it's not. Some women are excited by blood and violence, the bullfight, the prize ring. There are always as many women as men at these, and I have watched their faces. I have thought about myself, and still I do not know it all. I know only that I am attracted by strong men, powerful men. Aaron was such a man. I have not found many others since then." "Cruelty is not strength," Peter told her. "No. A truly strong man has that streak of gentleness and compassion. You are so strong, and yet when you make love to me, it is with extreme gentleness. though I can always feel the strength and cruelty there, held in bait, like the falcon under the hood. She moved away across the room, furnished in cream and chocolate and gold, and she tugged the embroidered bell pull that dangled from the corniced ceiling with its hand-painted panels, pastoral scenes of the type that Marie Antoinette had so admired. Peter knew that much of the furnishing of La Pierre Benite had been purchased at the auction sales with which the Revolutionary Committee dispersed the accumulated treasures of the House of Bourbon. With the other treasures, there were flowers. Wherever Magda Altman went, there were flowers. She came back to him as Roberto, the Italian butler, supervised the entry of the dinner trolley. And then Roberto filled the wine glasses himself, handling the bottles with white gloves as though they were part of the sacrament, and stationed himself ready to serve the meal. But Magda dismissed him with a curt gesture, and he bowed himself out silently. There was a presentation-wrapped parcel at Peter's place setting, tissue paper, an elaborately tied red ribbon. He looked up at her inquiringly as she served the soup into fragile Limoges bowls. "Once I began buying presents, I could not stop myself," she explained. "Besides, I kept thinking that bullet might have been in my back." Then she was impatient. "Are you not going to open it?" He did so carefully, and then was silent. "Africa, it is your speciality, is it not?" she asked anxiously. 19th-century Africa." He nodded, and reverently opened the cover of the volume in its bed of tissue paper. It was fully bound in maroon leather, and the state of preservation was quite extraordinary. Only the dedication on the fly leaf in the author's handwriting was faded yellow. "Where on earth did you find this?" he demanded. "It was at Sotheby's in 1971. I bid on it then." He had dropped out of the bidding at £5,000. "You do not have a first edition of Cornwallis Harris?" she asked again anxiously, and he shook his head, examining one of the perfectly preserved colour plates of African big game. "No, I do not. But how did you know that?" "Oh, I know as much about you as you do yourself," she laughed. "Do you like it?" "It is magnificent. I'm speechless." The gift was too extravagant, even for someone of her fortune. It troubled him, and he was reminded of the comedy situation of the husband who brings home flowers unexpectedly and is immediately accused by his wife. "Why, do you have a guilty conscience?" "Do you truly like it? I know so little about books." "It is the one edition I need to complete my major works," he said, "and it is probably the finest specimen left outside the British Museum." "I am so glad." She was genuinely relieved. "I was truly worried." And she put down the silver soup ladle and lifted both arms to welcome his embrace. During the meal, she was gay and talkative, and only when Roberto had wheeled away the trolley and they settled side by side on the down-filled couch before the fire did her mood change again. "Peter, today I have been unable to think of anything but this business, you and me and Caliph. I have been afraid, and I am still afraid. I keep thinking of Aaron, what they did to him, and then I think of you and what nearly happened.